From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, his wife and daughter killed in a missile strike on their home in Syria. He came here in late 2015 as his story grabbed the world's attention. Dr. Rafay Hamo tells us about his life in Michigan.
The welcoming of President Obama gave me a great respect and great push to settle here and start a new life.
Why West Michigan's economy is one of the healthiest in the nation.
Many of these businesses are family-owned, family-operated, and locally based. And what that does is that creates a tie back to the community.
A book of poems, essays, and photographs inspired by the Detroit People Mover.
Here's this gigantic city, a city that's physically larger than Manhattan, certainly where I grew up. But it's got this tiny, tiny train.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Am I curious?
Michigan Radio just wrapped up another round of Am I Curious, where you ask a question, then Michigan Radio listeners vote on the one they want us to investigate, and we do exactly that. Here's the winning question from listener Tim Patrick.
What happened to Dr. Rafay Hamo, the Syrian refugee featured in Humans of New York, who relocated to Southeast Michigan with his family?
Rafay Hamo's story grabbed the attention of the world when it was featured on the blog Humans of New York. Dr. Hamo is a highly accomplished engineer and professor. His wife, daughter, and other family members were killed when their home in Syria was struck by a missile. He fled Syria with his surviving children, a son and three daughters. And he was battling stomach cancer, brought on, he believed, by his sadness and his stress. After some time in Turkey, the family arrived in Southeast Michigan at the end of 2015. I sat down with the man who's come to be known as the scientist at his home. And with the help of interpreter Peter Alchona, we talked about his new life in Michigan. It has been over a year since you have come to Southeast Michigan. How are you settling into your life here?
We as a Kurdish, we came from a very cruel environment, and we were used to adjust ourselves according to that environment. So when we came here, we noticed that the American people have many common traditions that are same with Kurdish traditions, and this is very good for us. And of course, the most challenging thing in our stay here in America was the language, and of course, how to adjust and how to learn the language, as well as how to settle in this state.
Our listener, Tim Patrick, wanted to ask you, was there anything about Michigan that really surprised you?
I wasn't surprised with the situation in Michigan, but I look forward to see Michigan better and better. So one of the most important situations that I've noticed that is Detroit city situation, and I've seen that a lot of neighborhoods been neglected, and I wish that we can rebuild these places, which is a very important responsibility upon all the Michigans and also for all the people who come here. And I would love to be one of the people or one of the residents that help in developing and improving Detroit City and see it better and better.
Dr. Hamo, the post about you on the Humans of New York blog is the one where the world came to know you and touched people across the country, including President Obama, who wrote words of encouragement and then invited you to his final State of the Union speech in January of last year. What was that like to be the guest of the president?
My presence in the United States after I arrived to the state and President Obama welcomed me, that gave me a great momentum and for being present here. And also, as I don't consider myself as an immigrant, I consider myself as any other American citizen that requires to work and have duties and responsibility towards the people of Michigan and the state of Michigan. Also, the welcoming of President Obama gave me a great respect and great push to settle here and start a new life. And also I've noticed that their education, their culture are very great. I have respected very much and respected their culture and civilization here.
Tim Patrick, our listener, asked, when you arrived in Michigan, doctor, you said you didn't want to be treated only like a refugee and that you wanted to be a good citizen. How have you been treated, and have you been able to contribute to the community the way you wanted to?
It's a natural that any human beings that leave his natural homeland, it would, of course, suffer some changes, and of course will enter a new environment that is different than in his environment. But although the weather was a little bit different than our weather in Syria, but the traditions of the American people are very close to our tradition as Kurdish people, and of course we were able to adjust and accept our new place, our new home in Michigan.
And you wanted to contribute. Have you been able to find work?
Through the work, I'm only having one problem, which is the language.
When you first came here, there were reports that there was concerns that you had stomach cancer and that your health was a concern. How are you today? And did you have stomach cancer?
Yes.
That's right. I had a cancer, but I was able to get a treatment. I had a surgery to remove that cancer, and I'm still having some difficulties with my problem with the cancer. But thank God, I think that is stopped developing. The cancer is stopped growing, and I'm getting better every day.
And we are very happy to hear that, Doctor. We know one can never forget the pain of losing family members. But we do learn to live with that pain. And when you first got here, you were quoted as saying, "We survived, but we're dead psychologically." Have you begun to come back to life to recover psychologically?
Of course, with the time, we were recovering psychologically, but there's still something of the memories that were really bad to remember, and we always cannot forget. As a Kurdish people, we suffered a lot, especially after Sykes-Picot Treaty, and we've been suffering and from killing and displacing and putting in jail. But that was, we were able to overcome that, and we are now the people that we are after all these suffering, and we were able to adjust or to accommodate these environment or these situation to keep on living.
Have people in Michigan helped you in this by being welcoming and helping you build a new life here?
Unfortunately, I haven't received that much of help from any side or from any person. I was not hoping for any help, actually, but we were able to adjust to the situation. Now we have my son and my kids in school, and we are trying to overcome this problem and be able to adjust with the situation right now. For that help that we receive, we thank them as well. The Lutheran organization was one of the organizations that helped us.
You were invited to and you attended President Trump's inauguration. And as you know, he's just signed a new executive order that clamps down on travel and refugees from six mainly Muslim countries, including Syria. What are your thoughts about that?
So we look at America as a great country and also as a country of law. They have a very great laws that we should respect and honor. And as long as they have taken this step, we do respect these laws. But we ask the president, especially the American president, to stop the blood shed in Syria and all other places in the Arab countries, in Syria, and especially in Kurdistan. If they do that and stop that bloodshedding, I think my people and the Kurdish people will not need to leave their country and emigrate and find other countries to settle.
Back to you. You have this new life and this new home in Michigan for you and your family. What do you most hope to accomplish with your new life here?
طبعاً مجيئي لأمريكا هدفي الأساسي أن أحقق طموحي.
So my first goal from coming to the United States is to accomplish my ambitions. And these ambitions are to serve all the human beings, especially in the field of research and innovation. Now I started my work and I started a new research, scientific research center, but it's going very slowly. So far in the field of invention, I am working on one of the research, which is about earthquakes. We're trying to anticipate the earthquake and trying to avoid the consequences of that earthquakes.
I'm wondering if you would describe the Syrian people and the Kurd people for us. What do you want Americans to know about your people?
The Kurdish people in general are a persecuted people, been suffering for a long time through all ages since the Sykes-Picot Treaty, and now after 100 years they are still suffering. So our only hope that is to bring back our country, and I don't want to say established, but restore our country back and bring them safe, because we are the biggest people without country.
We want to thank you for inviting us into your very warm and beautiful home and for sharing your story with us. And we wish you luck, and we are glad that you are here in Michigan.
I would like to thank you also to accept my invitation to my simple house. And I hope that I will see you later and maybe in another occasion. And I don't want to be considered as a refugee. We are as Kurdish people. We don't like that. We consider ourselves as a citizen, and we work as a citizen, and we try to serve the community as a citizen in this state. And at the end, I would like to welcome you again in my humble house. And as I told you, thank you so much for being here.
Again, a special thanks to our interpreter, Peter Alchona of Bromberg and Associates. Our Am I Curious project is powered by you. To submit a question, all you have to do is go to michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last Friday evening, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra presented the world premiere of a new work titled Detroit 67 for Choir and Orchestra. It marks the 50th anniversary of those 5 days in July 1967, the civil unrest that changed Detroit in ways we're still facing today. The piece was composed by Terrence Blanchard. He's a Grammy-winning trumpeter, composer, bandleader, and arranger. And he's the Fred A. and Barbara M. Erb creative chair at the DSO. And it's a pleasure to say hello to Terrence Blanchard.
Hey, Cynthia, how are you doing?
Good. Great to have you with us. Terrence, what did you understand to be your remit in composing this piece?
We sat down and we initially talked about, you know, trying to capture what happened in the aftermath of the event. While it went on for 5 days, you know, there had to be a point of reflection for a lot of people to sit down and review what happened. Because, you know, a lot of people even today are still in disbelief about it all.
When you think of reflection, it almost takes a period of time to reflect, doesn't it?
It takes a period of time to just assess and reflect about everything. You know, I've gone through that, going through Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. So I understand what that initial moment of disbelief can be like.
And so how do you take such a major event in history, the thing that began on 12th Street in Detroit on July 67, and then it spread through parts of the city, leaving 43 people dead, nearly 1,200 injured, and you capture all of that in a composition. Can you walk us through the process?
Well, the first thing is you want to get as much information about the event as you can. So you talk to some people who are historians who could give you information, and you talk to some people who were there and experienced it. And the thing that I started to draw from my conversation from people is the interesting thing of, you know, the two separate views of it, whether it was a riot, you know, or whether it was a police action. It's interesting how people can experience the same event and look at it in totally different ways. But even having said that, I think one of the things that stuck out to me was the disbelief, you know, that people were expressing, you know, and how could this happen, you know, in Detroit? How could it happen in America? You know, we know things were tough at the time. There was a lot of civil unrest in the country. But for this to go on for 5 days the way that it did was something that still, even today, is unbelievable.
So then as you decide how you're going to write this piece and what it's going to sound like, what kind of instruments or what kind of melodies did you seize on that you felt, yep, that communicated best what happened during those days?
Well, since it's written for orchestra and choir, the thing is, it's not necessarily the, you know, one or two instruments. It's really about color. And for me, you know, I kept thinking of the silence that occurs in the aftermath of something like this, when the dust settles. So the piece starts off with just a few strings holding very sustained notes, you know, and then the reality hits. So then there's a couple of hits with low brass, you know, and percussion. And then what happens with the first movement is all about the aftermath. So what happens there is that there's a beautiful melody that starts, you know, very simplistically in French horn, and then it builds to a crescendo later on, because at a certain point, I would imagine there would have to be a certain level of rage that people would encounter, you know, when thinking about what just happened to them. So that's what I tried to do for the first movement, is deal with the total aftermath. But I have to tell you, you know, the second movement is all about hope and optimism. So first of all, it's done in a tonality, which is a major key, that lends itself musically to being optimistic and hopeful. It's all about, you know, where Detroit has come from, where it's gone, and where it's going. There's so many things that have been happening here in Detroit. I've been part of the DSO and the jazz series here for about 5.5 years now, and it's been amazing to witness the growth of the city. That's what the second movement is all about, moving forward, not letting an event tear the city apart and tear people apart. I see people coming together in beautiful ways to do a lot of great things here now. So that's initially where I started, but we have, since we have the choir here, you know, it starts with the choir singing. You know, because it reminded me of kind of like, you know, that moment when you're in church, when you start to understand that there are better days ahead if you just keep your head down and work hard and constantly go after your dreams.
What did you find, Terrence, to be the most challenging thing about putting this all together and producing what everybody heard last Friday night by the DSO?
Well, I think the most challenging thing for me was to try to get it right, you know, and not, you know, do something that was disrespectful or something that didn't fully represent what had happened and what was going on in the city right now. You know, to try to take the temperature of it. I mean, you know, for example, if it was something that was a piece that was written about New Orleans, then rhythmically, probably I would have done something totally different because of the musical heritage that existed in New Orleans. And what I tried to do here is not necessarily deal with Motown or the jazz influence here, but to deal with the city itself. And try to write something musically that was emblematic of what was going on here.
And it's interesting and so instructive to get fresh eyeballs, in a sense. And I know you grew up in Louisiana. You were only 5 when all of this happened.
Right.
So you bring a new view.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's also, you know, there's another component to it that's always just kind of strange for me, because I had a conversation with my mother years ago, and she told me my dad almost took a job here in Detroit, so this almost would have been my home at some point. So I have a certain type of relationship with the city because of that.
What are you hoping, Terrence, that audiences who hear Detroit 67 will get out of it? What kind of thoughts and reflections do you hope it inspires?
Well, I hope that it makes them reflect on where the city was at a moment in history, but realize that we're not there anymore and realize that there are a lot of great things that have happened in the city and there's more to come, and hopefully be energized to be a part of that growth and to be a part of the development, not sit on the sidelines.
Terrence Blanchard. He was honored last Friday at the Detroit Symphony Orchestra's Classical Roots Celebration, and that brought the world premiere of his composition, Detroit 67, for choir and orchestra, marking the 50th anniversary of the Detroit Uprising in the summer of 1967. Terrence, it was great talking with you. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Creation.
Vision.
The next idea.
What they have helped us do is to really think in a totally different way about how to deliver and create something new.
West Michigan is one of the most economically healthy regions in our state. And there's much to learn about digging into what's made West Michigan such a good place for businesses to take root and grow. The Right Place is an economic development organization, and it's helped thousands of West Michigan companies, creating some 40,000 jobs in the region. The Right Place is out with a new 3-year strategic plan to keep things humming along in West Michigan. Tim Mraz is a VP at The Right Place, and it's good to welcome you to The Next Idea, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
West Michigan's economy has been cited as the fifth fastest growing economy in this whole country. What do you think has made that possible?
You know, the one thing we always tell people is there's really no magic bullet to what's happening in West Michigan. You know, I think a lot of it goes to our entrepreneurial spirit here. One of the great things that we can always say about West Michigan is we weren't a city that was, or we aren't a community that was established by X company. It's been thousands of companies over the last 100 and some odd years that have really made West Michigan what it is today. Most of the buildings downtown that you see today, most of the successful businesses you see in the region are a result of businesses that were established here, have grown up here, and now in many cases are multi-generational.
It's certainly an ingredient that is working. And then looking ahead, how do you keep it all going?
Well, that is part of the secret here is, you know, one of the things that I'm always proud, you know, that The Right Place does along with the business and community here is looking out on the horizon to see what is happening on a global level, what is happening on a national level, and how that impacts what we do here on a regional and local level in West Michigan to determine our own future and our own fate and not have it happen to us.
So as you pull together this new 3-year strategic plan, what are the main building blocks? What's the economy need most in order to keep growing and succeeding?
Well, one of the things that we always try and focus on is what are those foundational elements of economic growth that need to be in place before we even start talking about industries or talent or anything like that. So in our new three-year strategic plan, the three areas of focus that we're going to be working on very hard over the next 3 years are on infrastructure, work-ready talent, and quality of life. Those are the kind of the three elements that we see that are going to really set a good foundation no matter what industry we're looking to attract or what business we're looking to attract.
Well, let's talk about that work-ready talent because we hear that a lot in the state of Michigan. What do you see as the barriers to getting the talent West Michigan needs? We often hear it said that businesses can't find the talent they need to fill the jobs they have, not just in West Michigan but throughout the state. So I'm just wondering what you see as some of the challenges in companies filling those jobs.
Well, one of the biggest challenges we have right now is simply our unemployment rate. You know, when you have an unemployment rate that hovers around 3%, you know, plus or minus a tenth of a percent here and there, depending on where you are in the region, the lack of available talent is just not there. You know, and the remaining talent that is left, the remaining workforce that is left, may not have the skills to fulfill or qualify for the jobs that are remaining. So part of the work that we're doing at The Right Place is collaborating with organizations like the Michigan Work System, Goodwill Industries in West Michigan, and a plethora of other workforce development agencies and our community colleges to really build a system that helps those former workers re-engage.
That's important, the kind of things that can be done to help workers get qualifications, but ones that really mean something, ones that will that aren't just a piece of paper and a certificate, but ones that will actually lead to vibrant careers.
Well, and that's one of the great things about West Michigan that a lot of people realize when once they come here is the level of public-private collaboration that happens here. And I know that term gets thrown around a lot, but you really see it put to use here in West Michigan. You see private businesses that are working every day with Grand Rapids Community College, Grand Valley State University, Michigan Works, and having that open dialogue saying, this is not just what I have today in terms of needs for my workforce, but here's what I'm going to need over the next 3 to 5 years. How can you help in your curriculum? How can you help in workforce training to really make those connections and help us grow our talent pool so that my business can continue growing in the region?
What do you see as the main strategic growth areas for West Michigan?
You know, there's several major areas of industry growth here that we're seeing, not just today, but in the future in West Michigan. One is obviously in food processing and ag. West Michigan is a breadbasket, really, when it comes to agricultural products. And what we're seeing in the food processing industry is West Michigan is really becoming a destination, not just because of talent, but because of our location and access to fresh water and our access to an immediate food supply chain. So we expect a lot of growth in terms of food processing. Life sciences obviously continues to grow. If you see what's going on along Michigan Street in downtown Grand Rapids, and you see what's going on in the industry in the area, we have medical device manufacturers. You know, one of the things that's very interesting that I don't think a lot of people realize is West Michigan has the largest concentration of medical device manufacturers in the state. And so, you know, we expect to see a lot more growth in that sector as well. And then finally, in terms of technology, last year we announced the data center company Switch coming to West Michigan. We already had a hotbed of technology companies already here, so we expect that just to continue to grow as well.
How much does what happens elsewhere in the state matter to West Michigan's economy? For example, how does the economic health in Flint or Detroit matter to West Michigan?
Well, we have always said West Michigan is not an island, and so goes the state of Michigan, so goes Detroit, so goes West Michigan. We're all in this game together. We're all part of one state.
Well, when you think of it from the other side, how does West Michigan's economic health matter to other regions in the state?
Well, we saw back in 2008, 2009, when Michigan was having some very troubled economic times, one of the things that we noticed is that West Michigan, we dipped, economically, but not as much as other communities around the state. And, one of the strengths of West Michigan is the diversity of our industry base. You know, you look at other communities, especially around the Midwest, and they tend to be very industry-specific or industry-focused. And so when you hit hard economic times or more difficult economic times, like we had in 2008, 9, 10, and even some would argue even into 2011, West Michigan was able to weather those economic conditions a lot stronger than many other communities. The other big asset that West Michigan has in terms of business is many of these businesses are family-owned, family-operated, and locally based. And what that does is that creates a tie back to the community. And a lot of these companies tend to not overstretch themselves or over-leverage themselves. So when you fall on hard economic times, they have those cash reserves to pull from, and they can keep those companies moving forward instead of having a downturn in the economy happen to them.
Are these lessons that other regions can look at and apply now?
I think so. Obviously, every community is unique in terms of their local economy, their local industry makeup, and how they're structured. But I think, some of the important things are, really around dialogue, making sure that your partners in local government are at the table, making sure your business leaders are at the table, making sure that your assets in terms of infrastructure, whether it be, you know, electric, water and sewer, broadband is another huge issue, making sure that those voices are at the table as well when you're starting to plan for future economic growth.
Tim Meraz is with The Right Place, an economic development organization that is out with its new 3-year strategic plan for West Michigan. Thanks so much for being with us on The Next Idea, Tim.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, a new book of poems, essays, and photographs inspired by the Detroit People Mover.
Here's this gigantic city, a city that's physically larger than Manhattan, certainly where I grew up, but it's got this tiny, tiny train.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Call it the worldwide auto dating game. GM bails on its European market as it sells off its Opel and Vauxhall units to the French PSA Group. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House thinks there will be more corporate dating and matchmaking to come. Daniel, what does GM get in selling off Opel and Vauxhall?
Money. More money. And I don't mean money in terms of from the sale, because effectively they're spending more than they're getting in terms of assuming pension liabilities. But they do free up capital that they can reinvest in other parts of the business that they think they're going to get a better return. Look, this is very different from the General Motors we've known for decades and decades. That group was always very conservative. They always felt that they needed to be a player, if not the lead player, in every part of the world, regardless of how good or mediocre or poorly they were doing in that part of the world. And this new leadership and this new board of directors has basically said, we're not going to do that anymore. Their goal is to be the most valuable and valued car company in the world, and this is one step in that direction.
GM's share price fell 1% after Monday's announcement. Is the market unsure about this?
Yes. I mean, I think anytime you give up revenue and walk out of one of the big three markets in the world, people are going to say, well, what are you doing? And secondarily, Opel had been a major producer and developer of small cars for General Motors worldwide. Now, I think that that ultimately means that other parts of the world, like China and South Korea, are going to play a bigger role in developing smaller vehicles for General Motors worldwide.
And what you just said about Opel being behind GM's, you know, best passenger car designs, is GM putting those passenger cars on the back burner in favor of the SUVs and trucks that are cheaper to make and more profitable than, let's say, the Buicks?
I think the short answer is yes. I mean, clearly at the Fiat Chrysler, you've seen them clearly do that and basically say we're getting out of the car business in the United States. But I think General Motors is to some extent downscaling that, but not necessarily. I mean, you're not hearing them saying we're going to get out of segments in the marketplace like FCA is. They're not moving production of cars to Mexico like Ford is. So they're clearly going to stay in the business in this market, and I think they feel like they need to. But they've also come to the conclusion that, you know, Opel, there was only about a 20% overlap between Opel and the rest of the world for General Motors. So it wasn't as big of a contributor as sometimes people think. They kind of looked at the overall landscape and said the world is changing here, and it's not changing in a way that we necessarily want to play, because in order to play in Europe, they were going to have to invest an awful lot in new emissions technologies. The trade relationships with Brexit were going to change, and they just felt that this was they'd be throwing good money after bad.
And to that point, Daniel, your column in the Detroit News today reminds us that FCA's Sergio Marchionne is out trying to play the dating game.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. They announced this thing on Monday. Everybody's getting ready to go to Geneva for the International Motor Show. And then, of course, on Tuesday, Sergio basically reignites the talk of looking for a partner. Expects Volkswagen to come calling. Volkswagen says, no, we're not. My preferred partner is GM. GM says, we've had this discussion before, not interested. Carlos Ghosn at Renault-Nissan, who's just picked up the chairmanship of Mitsubishi Motors, basically says that another wave of consolidation is coming, and I think he's probably right in some way, shape, or form. And then you have got other people like Mercedes-Benz saying, hey, we're in a class by ourselves. We don't need you. We don't need anybody. So, you know, it's all, I love the preening and the posturing and the you need me and no, I don't. And, you know, we predict consolidation, but we're not going to be part of the consolidation wave, you know, so it's always going to happen to somebody else and not me. But I think there's not any question that particularly the American companies are getting a little bit more aggressive in saying, you know what, we're not going to be in this business anymore. And I think you're going to see more of that. I think you're going to see it from Ford, which, you know, has but for the compact car business, has basically been maintaining status quo. But I do know that inside Ford, there's a growing debate at a very high level and very intense about saying, we need to look that there may be some parts of this business that we have been in forever that we don't need to be in anymore because we're just not getting the return on the investment. And ultimately, what these companies are fighting is the perception of old Detroit versus, you know, the kind of earnings that they are generating now. I mean, they're making more money than they've made in most people's lifetimes in the United States, and the market is basically yawning. And that's a source of great frustration at those companies.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Think of it as an artistic fan letter to Detroit's people mover. University of Michigan artist Nick Tobier's new book is Looping Detroit, a people mover travelogue, a collection of essays, poems, and photographs inspired by the Detroit people mover and the views it offers of the city's geography and culture. Nick Tobier is a professor at the Stamps School of Art and Design at U of M. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks so much.
It often takes, I think, someone with fresh eyes to come in and appreciate and see something that the locals tend to take for granted, or is often the case with the people mover, maybe smirk at or overlook. You're from New York City?
Yes, yeah.
Well, what struck you about the people mover when you first came to Detroit and first saw it?
You know, I grew up in New York, and I took the subway to and from places at a pretty young age. And you can pretty much get on at one end and get off at the other, but it's 2.5 hours, and you go through sort of big changes in neighborhoods. And the people mover, you can, if you stand in one spot, you can see both ends of it. And each stop is about 150 yards from the next one. So I was fascinated that here's this gigantic city, a city that's physically larger than Manhattan, certainly where I grew up, but it's got this tiny, tiny train. And there was something, you know, sort of anti-heroic about it.
I think that's a very safe way to describe it.
Yeah.
But then what did it say to you about its relationship to the city and to the people in the city?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So at the time, I think the time I first wrote it, I was working with a group of fourth graders at a school at Greenfield Union that's 7 Mile in Woodward. We had a field trip. I don't know how we even organized that in the buses. And we came all the way downtown. And for a lot of the students, that was a long way. You know, we saw things that either they had been to or they hadn't been to. And we rode the people mover. Every kid got 2 tokens. I think the idea with the 2 tokens is if someone got separated from the group, they could get back on. And every time it would go over the back, over the Detroit River, between the Cobo Center stop, and it's amazing. You know, all the kids would go, whee, because you're cantilevered over the river, and it's like magic. So at that point, I saw it as something somewhat like an amusement park ride because we were the only ones on it. But we got off because the idea would be that we would get off at every stop and explore it. But these were 9, 10 years old, so we couldn't do that. So we got off and we walked to Capitol Park, which at that point was, there were some check cashing stores, and it was where the buses came in and out before they built the Rosa Parks Transit Center. And there were people sort of trading transfers, and it was a place where people from the east side and the west side would encounter one another. But there was no interchange with the people mover. So I started thinking about how we had gotten there from, you know, 7 Mile and Woodward, took school buses, but there would be no way that you would take the people mover for transit. So I started going back to Capitol Park and talking to people about how they got around and, you know, what they thought of this people mover and what the city meant to them. And the discussions became really political. As I learned more how the people mover was built, or the understanding was that it was a promise that was part of a larger mass transit system. But the mass transit only reached that small loop of downtown. And at that point, the things that occur in that part of Detroit right now in terms of development and gentrification were nowhere on the horizon.
It was,
not at all. 2004, 2005, and it seemed like a sort of an epic cost for a very small percentage of people, you know, who might work in the Renaissance Center or the Penobscot building, who would park in secure parking garages, maybe come in from the suburbs, leave their car where it was, and never have to touch the city. So I was, you know, increasingly aware of the distance between the ground and that space above it where the people mover and all those garages were.
Well, I, you know, dating myself here, I clearly remember when the people mover was being talked about and planned for, and then it first opened in July 87. In fact, by that point, we'd already had the Detroit Grand Prix running in those streets around the Rance End, because that started in 1982.
Oh,
so that even beat that.
Yeah.
And certainly at the time, and since, it has drawn a fair degree of ridicule, like, woohoo, 2.94-mile track in a circle. Like you say,
right.
this tiny trail. But what are we missing when we shrug it off that way?
Well, I guess we're missing some of the arc of why it is. You know, that there was a promise that this would be the start of something, and that when investment always starts downtown in the same place, rather than saying, how do we tie in the vast network to come downtown, there's that. You know, there's sort of the political end of the spectrum. And there's also the part that if you take it in a way as an opportunity to discover rather than, you know, go from destination to destination. So I think that was one of the things. You know, there was a bit of a irony to it that it was such a small loop, but I had been sort of aware of other projects that use a train, whether it's like the Trans-Siberian Railroad or the sort of Paris to Shanghai, or there's this epic journey that uses the train as its spine. There's a beautiful book about a line that tourists take from Paris to get to De Gaulle Airport.
I've done that.
You have? Yeah.
I have.
And
yep.
You probably didn't get off along the way.
Well, you're jet-lagged and you've got your suitcases and all you'd want to do is get to the hotel.
Get to your destination.
You're right. You don't.
But you pass through neighborhoods that during the Sarkozy administration were the sort of center of immigration hostility and race riots and actions by the police and judgments. One of the authors I cite in here, this guy Francois Maspero, decided to take it and get off at each stop and spend the night. So initially I thought maybe I could do that with the People Mover. At that point, there were very few or almost no hotels. I think there was the Shelby Hotel. There was the Pontchartrain. You couldn't go that far and spend the night. But I wanted to see what I could do in sort of that small radius and treat it in the same way that you might a longer journey.
Now you have this book, this fascinating collection of essays and poems and photographs, and they're pegged around every stop of the People Mover.
Yeah.
And I love that you invited writers and photographers to contribute. And when you invited them, what was your ask?
I'd like you to pick a stop of the People Mover and get on it and off it and explore that stop as you would an explorer. And the only restrictions are that it can't be anything that you might find, say, in a photo's guide to Detroit. And so I'm not looking for something that would be a nice tourist attraction, but see what's there, and it doesn't have to even be there anymore. There's some that are sort of rooted in memory of places that were. And the other was that I wanted to share the journey. So I recognize that I've been in this area now 14 years, and I don't consider myself a local in any way. And I do recognize that I'm an outsider both in that I live in Ann Arbor and I teach at the University of Michigan, and I recognize that Detroit is a complex city where race and class are, at least in my Detroit, have always been part of the conversation. And I worry and I recognize that the second that's not part of the conversation is when we've really reached a problem.
And certainly there are some wonderful essays and poems. And I'm almost, as I look at your book, plus these photographs, I see a traveling show. You should mount
a thing.
Oh,
that's really interesting.
Yeah. Get some of these folks. You have rappers who are doing this. You have people who would love to read their essays. I think it would be fascinating because it does explore so many sides of the city that we don't think of. One I really love is Zach Rosen's essay on riding the People Mover and then getting lost in the Rensen. And we're going to have that on our website at michiganradio.org
really
so people can hear Zach reading it. But the point is, when the Rensen opened in 77, it was this fortress, and it had this berm, and it cut itself off, and it cut the riverfront off.
Yeah.
It's so indicative of what you're saying here, too, that
That's
people
right.
are cut off.
If you walk through any of the tubes that connect, you can pretty much get from the Rensen to Millinder Center, one of the next stops, without ever touching the ground, and you don't feel the weather. And so I think some of the times that the People Mover is most used are during the auto show, when you hear, you know, people speaking Japanese and Italian taking it during hockey games. You know, the great thing is to take it off hours and to get on and off as much as possible.
What surprised you as you put this book together?
I think the complex relationship that people had with a neighborhood that is in transition or no longer there. So like Lolita Hernandez talks about Greektown and her doing things with her father around that time and refers to these suit stores that, you know, there are a few that are about to close and they'll probably become craft bars and microbrews. The longer arc of a relationship with a place in a city as it changes around you is what's really striking to me. That you could come in and out, say if you came to Detroit for a week or a month, and you could say, this is what it looks like and this is how it's always been. But like I understand from growing up in New York, where my mother's never left, her relationship with the city is continual and mine is episodic. So I may not go there for a year and I won't notice the changes in the same way, or I will notice in the same way. So as things close or open.
When I think about what you have in this book, in Looping Detroit, a People Mover travelogue, and as we speak, some 30 years after the People Mover carried its first passenger, the city's going to get the new Q line, the M1 line that's going to run up and down Woodward, basically from the People Mover to Midtown.
Right.
You share some thoughts about the M1 in the epilogue of your book. So what are your views of this soon-to-open 3.3-mile line?
Well, I think it's a similar type of promise, that it's serving the area of the city that is, I would say, most resourced in terms of sort of anchor institutions, whether it's Wayne State or the Medical Center and some of the sort of corporate anchor tenants. Frankly, the Woodward buses work quite well. If there's any area of the city where public transportation works quite well, it's that. And to see the same type of investment in the same part of the city, I think, what did we learn in 30 years? We learned that we're going to focus on the areas that we've already focused on, and we're going to leave the largest swath of population and city continually underserved, and I think that's a shame. It is the 30th anniversary of the People Mover. I did get some contact from marketing at the People Mover that was aware of the book, and I would love to do an event on the People Mover. My, you know, great hope would be that we would do it together. You know, there are definitely sections of the book that are critical of it as well as appreciative, and I think wherever we are in our cities, that we need those sort of outside and inside voices to be both critical and appreciative. So I'd love the idea of poets and writers and MCs getting on at different stops or performing at the platform. I think it would be really great.
Keep pushing that. I think it would be great, too. Nick, do you hold any hope that one day Southeast Michigan, the Detroit area, would have the kind of mass transit system, like you described it when you grew up in New York, or that you see when we go to Chicago, that gets people all around? There's pluses, no having to find free parking or get stuck in traffic congestion.
Yeah.
Could that ever happen?
Well, I was really disappointed that the millage didn't pass. You know, I think regional transit is one of our hopes. I mean, my hope, you know, I spend most of my sort of artistic and work time in Brightmoor in Detroit, which I can get to in 28 minutes from my home in Ann Arbor. That will take me longer to get from Brightmoor to downtown. But if there were a way to get from Ann Arbor to Detroit by public transit, we'd have a much better sense of the relationship between our cities and the regions that they're part of. So that's a regional solution, an interurban or point-to-point in Detroit where you don't have to wait for bus connections that don't happen, is something that American cities have not done well at, especially those that are sort of built in a sort of a diffuse square footage.
And when you think of what it could mean for the parts of Detroit that are not downtown or midtown or Corktown or homes to Detroit's four pro sports teams soon
That's right.
Plenty of areas that could be served well.
Yeah. And we'd gain so much by having those areas connected. I mean, I think that's one thing I'm always struck by in the several years when I worked on the east side, that was where my social life was. And now when I'm sort of northwest corner, I rarely see those friends unless we make specific plans, and it's a bit of an ordeal to get to that. So some of the things that enables are really distinct neighborhood cultures, and some of the things that enables is really distinct segregation, whether it's on race or class or ethnic lines. I think we're doing ourselves a disservice by not enabling people to connect. I also am a big fan of sort of social transportation, even if I'm not talking to someone, but I'd prefer to travel with people. So I miss a crowded subway or a crowded bus. And I think that's something that maybe not everybody likes it, but to talk to someone just by chance, whether they get on or off at the next stop, is something that enables.
Nick Tobier's book, Looping Detroit, a People Mover Travelogue. And you got to let us know if you're able to get some of these great MCs and rappers and artists and photographers traveling show. You've got to do it.
Oh, I'd love to.
Thanks so much for having me, Cynthia. And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.